practice of starting the meeting. But today's an exception because there's something I need to get off my chest. Something that's hard for me to say. So here goes. About a month ago, I learned that I have a serious, I'll be frank, more than serious, a life-threatening form of skin cancer. Malignant melanoma. I thought I was in good health. This turned up at a recent routine physical exam. Julia stopped. Something was off kilter. The members' facial expression and nonverbal language weren't right. Their posture was wrong. They should have been turned toward him, focusing on him. Instead, no one fully faced him. No one met his gaze. All eyes were averted, unfocused, except for Rebecca, who covertly studied the sheet of paper in her lap. "What's happening?" asked Julius. "I feel like I'm not making contact. You all seem preoccupied with something else today. And, Rebecca, what is that you're reading?" Rebecca immediately folded the paper, buried it in her purse, and avoided Julius's gaze. Everyone sat quietly until Tony broke the silence. "Well, I gotta talk. I can't talk for Rebecca, but I'll talk for myself. My problem when you were speaking was that I already know what you're gonna tell us about your health. So it was hard to look at you and pretend I was hearing something new. And yet I just couldn't interrupt you to tell you that I knew it already." "How? What do you mean you knew what I was going to say? What in hell is going on today?" "Julius, I'm sorry, let me explain," said Gil. "I mean, in a way, I'm to blame. After the last meeting, I was still frazzled and not clear about when or whether to go home or where to sleep that night. I really put pressure on everyone to come to the coffee shop, where we continued the meeting." "Yeah, and?" Julius coaxed, moving his hand in a small circle as though conducting an orchestra. "Well, Philip told us what the score was. You know, about your health and about the malignant myeloma."
"Melanoma,"
Philip softly interjected. Gil glanced at the paper in his hand. "Right, melanoma. Thanks, Philip. Keep doing that. I get mixed up."
"Multiple myeloma is a cancer of the bone," said Philip. "Melanoma is a cancer of the skin. Think of melanin, pigment, skin coloring."
"So those sheets are?" interrupted Julius, gesturing with his hand to invite Gil or Philip to explain. "Philip downloaded information about your medical condition and prepared a summary, which he handed out just as we entered the room a few minutes ago." Gil extended his copy toward Julius, who saw the heading, "Malignant Melanoma." Staggered, Julius sat back in his chair. "I don't know how to put it. I feel preempted. I feel like I had a big news story to tell you, and I've been scooped. Scooped on my own life story. Or death story." Turning and speaking directly to Philip, Julius said, "Had you any guesses about how I'd feel about that?" Philip remained impassive, neither replying nor looking at Julius.
"That's not entirely fair, Julius," said Rebecca, who removed her barrette, loosened her long black hair, and twisted it into a coil on the top of her head. "He's not at fault here. First of all, Philip did not, in the worst way, want to go to the coffee shop after the meeting. Said he didn't socialize, said he had a class to prepare. We had to practically drag him there."
"Right," Gil took over. "We talked mostly about me and my wife and where I should sleep that night. Then, of course, we all asked Philip about why he was in therapy, which is only natural. Every new member gets asked that. And he told us about your phone call to him, which was prompted by your illness. That news jolted us.
and we couldn't let it pass without pressing him to tell us what he knew. Looking back, I don't see how he could have withheld that from us.
Philip even asked, Rebecca added,
whether it was kosher for the group to meet without you.
Kosher? Philip said that? Asked Julius.
Well, no, said Rebecca. Come to think of it, kosher was my term, not his.
But that was his meaning.
And I told him that we often had a post-group session at the coffee shop, and that you've never raised objections about it except to insist that we debrief everyone who wasn't there in the next meeting so that there be no secrets.
It was good that Rebecca and Gil gave Julius time to calm himself. His mind churned with negativity.
That ungrateful prick. That undercutting bastard. I try to do something for him, and this is what I get for it. No good deed goes unpunished. And I can imagine how little he told the group about himself, and why he had been in therapy with me in the first place. I'd lay big money that he conveniently forgot to tell the group that he had screwed about 1,000 women without an ounce of care or compassion for a single one of them.
But he kept all these thoughts to himself, and gradually cleansed his mind of rancor by considering the events following the last meeting. He realized that, of course, the group would have pressured Philip to attend a post-group coffee, and that Philip would have been swayed by the group pressure to attend. Indeed, he himself was at fault for not having informed Philip about these periodic post-group get-togethers. And, of course, the group would have questioned Philip about why he was in therapy. Gil was right. The group never failed to pose this question to a new member. And, of course, Philip would have to reveal the story of their unusual history and subsequent contract for therapy. What choice did he have? As for his distributing medical information on malignant melanoma, that was Philip's own idea. No doubt his way of ingratiating himself with the group. Julius felt wobbly, couldn't pull off a smile, but braced himself and continued. Well, I'll do my best to talk about this. Rebecca, let me get a good look at that sheet. Julius quickly scanned it. These medical facts seem accurate, so I won't repeat them. But I'll just fill you in on my experience. It started with my doctor spotting an unusual mole on my back, which a biopsy confirmed was a malignant melanoma. Of course, that's why I canceled the group. Had a rough couple of weeks. Really rough, letting it sink in. Julius's voice quavered. As you see, it's still rough. He paused, took a deep breath, and continued. My doctors can't predict my future, but what is important here is that they feel strongly I have at least a year of good health ahead. So this group will be open for business as usual for 12 months. No, wait, let me put it this way. Health permitting, I commit myself to meet with you for one more year, at which time this group will terminate. Sorry to be clumsy about it, but I've had no practice at this.
Julius, is this seriously life-threatening? Asked Bonnie. Philip's internet information, all these statistics based on stages of the melanoma.
Straight question, and the straight answer is yes. Definitely life-threatening. The chances are good that this thing will get me in the future. I know that wasn't an easy question to ask, but I appreciate your straightforwardness, Bonnie. Because I'm like most people with major illness. I hate everyone to be pussyfooting around. That would just isolate and frighten me. I've got to get used to my new reality. I don't like it. But life as a healthy, carefree person... Well, that life is definitely coming to an end.
I'm thinking of what Philip said to Gil last week. I wonder, is there something of value in there for you, Julius?
Asked Rebecca.
I'm not sure if it was in the coffee shop or here in the group, but it had to do with defining yourself or your life by your attachments. Do I have it right, Philip?
When I spoke to Gil last week, said Philip, speaking in a measured tone and avoiding eye contact, I pointed out that the more attachments one has, the more burdensome life becomes, and the more suffering one experiences when one is separated from these attachments. Schopenhauer and Buddhism both hold that one must release oneself from attachments, and I don't think that is helpful to me, interrupted Julius. And I'm also not sure if this is where this meeting should be going. He noted a quick, pregnant glance passing between Rebecca and Gil, but continued. I come in on that in the opposite way. Attachments, and plenty of them, are the indispensable ingredients of a full life. And to avoid attachments because of anticipated suffering is a sure recipe for being only partially alive. I don't mean to cut you off, Rebecca, but I think it more to the point to go back to your reactions, everyone's reactions, to the announcement I've made. Obviously, learning of my cancer has got to stir up strong feelings. I've known many of you for a long time. Julius stopped talking and looked around at his patients. Tony, who had been slumped in his chair, stirred himself. Well, I had a jolt when you said earlier that what should be important to us was how long you could continue to lead this group. That comment got under my skin, thick-skinned as I've been accused of being. Now, I don't deny that crossed my mind, but Julius, I'm mostly upset at what this means for you. I mean, let's face it, you've been pretty, really important to me. Helped me get over some really bad stuff. I mean, is there something we can do for you? This has got to be terrible for you. Ditto for me, said Gil, and all the others, save Philip, joined in assent. I'm going to respond, Tony, but first say how touched I am, and how impossible it would have been for you a couple of years ago to be so direct and to reach out so generously. But to answer your question, it's been terrible. My feelings come in waves. I hit bottom the first couple of weeks when I canceled the group. Did a lot of non-stop talking to my friends, my whole support network. Right now, at this moment, I'm doing better. You get used to everything, even mortal illness. Last night, the refrain, life is just one goddamn loss after another, kept passing through my mind. Julius stopped. No one spoke. Everyone stared at the floor. Julius added, I want to deal with it openly. Willing to discuss everything. I won't shy away from anything. But unless you ask something specific, I'm talked out now, plus I don't feel I need the whole meeting to be given to me today. I want to say I have energy to work with you here in my usual way. In fact, it's important to me that we go on as we always have. After a short silence, Bonnie said, I'll be honest, Julius. There's something I could work on, but I don't know. My problems seem insignificant compared to what you're going through. Gil looked up and added, Me too. My stuff, whether or not I learn to talk to my wife, stay with her, or leave the sinking ship, all that seems trivial in comparison. Philip took that as his cue. Spinoza was fond of using a Latin phrase, sub specie aeternitatis, meaning, from the aspect of eternity. He suggested that disturbing quotidian events become less unsettling if they are viewed from the aspect of eternity. I believe that concept may be an underappreciated tool in psychotherapy. Perhaps, and here Philip turned and addressed Julius directly, It may offer a form of solace to even the kind of serious assault you're facing.
I can see you're trying to offer me something, Philip, and I appreciate that. But right now, the idea of taking a cosmic eye view of life is the wrong flavor of medicine. Let me tell you why. Last night I didn't sleep well, and got to feeling sad for not having appreciated what I had at the very moment it was happening. When I was young, I always regarded the present as a prelude to something better that was going to occur. And then, the years passed, I suddenly found myself doing the opposite. I was bathing myself in nostalgia. What I've not done enough of is to treasure each moment. And that's the problem with your solution of detachment. I think it faces life through the wrong end of a telescope.
I gotta come in here, Julius, said Gil, with an observation. I don't think there's much chance that you're going to accept anything that Philip says.
An observation I'll always pay attention to, Gil. But that's an opinion. Where's the observation?
Well, the observation is that you're just not respecting anything he offers.
I know what Julius would say about that, Gil, said Rebecca. It's still not an observation. It's a guess about his feelings. What I observe, she turned to Julius, is that this is the first time you and Philip have addressed one another even halfway directly, and that you have interrupted Philip a few times today, something I never see you do with anyone else.
Touché, Rebecca, answered Julius. Right on. A direct and accurate observation.
Julius, said Tony, I'm not getting the picture at all. You and Philip, what's going on? I don't get it. Is he right when he says you phoned him out of the blue?
Julius sat with his head bowed for a few minutes and then said,
Yes, I can see how confusing this must be for all of you. Okay, here it is straight. Or as straight as my memory permits. After my diagnosis, I fell into real despair. I felt I had gotten a death sentence, and I was staggered by it. Among other dark thoughts, I began to question whether anything I had done in my life had any enduring meaning whatsoever. I slogged around in that question for a day or two, and since my life is so intertwined with my work, I began thinking of patients I'd seen in the past. Had I really, permanently, affected anyone's life? I felt I had no time to waste, and so, on the spot, I decided to contact some of my old patients. Philip was the first person, and so far the only one, I reached.
And why select Philip? Asked Tony.
That's the $64,000 question. Or maybe that's dated. Is it the $64 million question these days? Short answer. I'm not sure. I've wondered about it a lot. It wasn't smart of me because if I wanted reassurance of my worth, there are a lot of better candidates. Try as hard as I did for a full 3 years, I didn't help Philip. Maybe I was hoping that he would report some delayed effect of therapy. Some patients report such a thing. But it didn't turn out that way for him. Maybe I was being masochistic, wanting to rub my nose in it. Maybe I chose my biggest failure in order to give myself a second chance. I admit it. I frankly don't know my motives. And then, during the course of our discussion, Philip told me of his career change and asked if I would be willing to be his supervisor. Philip? Julius turned to face Philip. I assume you filled the group in on this?
I provided the necessary details.
Can you be a little more cryptic? Philip looked away. The rest of the group looked uncomfortable, and after a long silence, Julius said, I apologize for the sarcasm, Philip. But can you see where your answer left me?
As I said,
I provided the necessary details to the others, Philip said.
Bonnie turned to face Julius.
I'll be up front. This feels unpleasant, and I'm rescuing you. I don't think you need to be hassled today. I think you need to be taken care of. Please, what can we do for you today?
Thanks, Bonnie. You're right. I am shaky today. Your question's a lovely one, but I'm not sure I can answer it. I'll tell you all a big secret. There have been times I've entered this room feeling bad because of some personal issues, and left feeling better just as a result of being part of this terrific group. So maybe that's the answer to your question. The best thing for me is simply for all of you to use the group and not let my situation bring us to a total stop. After a short silence, Tony said,
Tough assignment with what's gone down today.
Right, said Gil. It'll feel awkward to talk about anything else.
These are the times I miss Pam, said Bonnie. She was the one who always knew what to do, no matter how awkward the situation.
Funny, I was thinking about her earlier, too, said Julius.
It must be telepathy, said Rebecca. Just a minute ago, Pam went through my mind also. It was when Julius talked about successes and failures.
She turned to Julius.
I know she was your favorite child in our family here, and that's not a question. It's so obvious. What I'm wondering is whether you feel like you failed with her. You know, her taking a couple months off to seek another kind of therapy because we couldn't help her. That can't be great for your self-esteem.
Julius gestured toward Philip. Maybe you should fill him in.
Pam's a real force here, Rebecca said to Philip, who did not meet her eyes. Both her marriage and a relationship with a lover fell apart. She decided to leave her marriage, but then the lover opted not to leave his wife. She got upset with both men and obsessed about them day and night. Try as we could, we never found a way to help her. In desperation, she took off for India to seek help from a famous guru at a Buddhist meditation retreat.
Philip made no response. Rebecca turned back to face Julius.
So how did you feel about her taking off?
You know, up to about 15 years ago, I would have been very uptight. More than that, I might even have taken a strong stand against it, and insisted that her search for another form of enlightenment was just resistance to change. I've changed. Now I feel I need all the help I can get. And I've found that participation in some other mode of growth, even flaky stuff, can often open up new areas for our therapeutic work. And I sure hope that will be true for Pam.
It may have been not a flaky, but an excellent choice for her, said Philip. Schopenhauer felt positive about Eastern meditative practice and its emphasis on mind clearing, on seeing through illusion, and its approach to relieving suffering by teaching the art of letting go of attachments. In fact, he was the first to introduce Eastern thought into Western philosophy.
Philip's comment was made to no one in particular, and no one responded. Julius felt irritated at hearing Schopenhauer's name so often, but kept it to himself, as he noted several members nodding in appreciation of Philip's remarks. After a brief silence, Stuart commented,
Shouldn't we go back to where we were a few minutes ago when Julius said that what would be best for him would be for us to get to work in the group?
I agree, said Bonnie, but where to start? How about a follow-up on you and your wife, Stuart? Last we heard, she emailed you that she was thinking of leaving the marriage.
It's settled down and we're back to status quo. She's keeping her distance, but at least things are no worse. Let's see what else is pending in the group.
Stuart looked around the room.
I can think of two items. Gil, how about you and Rose? What's been happening there? And Bonnie,
You said earlier today you had something to work on, but it felt too trivial.
I want to pass today, said Gil, looking downward. I took too much time last week. But the bottom line is defeat and capitulation. I'm ashamed to be back home in the same situation. All that good advice from Philip, from all of you, was wasted on me. How about you, Bonnie?
My stuff feels like small potatoes today.
Remember my version of Boyle's Law, said Julius. A small amount of anxiety will expand to fill our whole anxiety cavity. Your anxiety feels just as awful as anxiety in others that comes from more obviously calamitous sources. He looked at his watch. We're just about out of time. But do you want to open it up? Get on the agenda?
To stop me from chickening out next week, you mean? Asked Bonnie. Well, that's not a bad idea. What I was going to bring up has to do with my being homely and fat and clumsy, and Rebecca, and also Pam, being beautiful and stylish. But Rebecca, you especially, open up a lot of painful old feelings for me. Feelings I've always had about being klutzy, homely, unchosen.
Bonnie stopped and looked at Julius.
There. It's out.
And on the agenda for next week, said Julius, rising to signal the end of the meeting. 14. A person of high, rare mental gifts who is forced into a job which is merely useful is like a valuable vase decorated with the most beautiful painting and then used as a kitchen pot. 1807. How Arthur Schopenhauer almost became a merchant. The Schopenhauer family's grand tour ended in 1804, and the 16-year-old Arthur, with a heavy heart, honored his pledge to his father by commencing his 7-year apprenticeship with Senator Jenisch, an eminent Hamburg merchant. Slipping into a double life, Arthur fulfilled all the quotidian tasks of his apprenticeship, but surreptitiously spent every spare moment studying the great ideas of intellectual history. He had so internalized his father, however, that these stolen moments filled him with remorse. Then, 9 months later, came the staggering event that marked Arthur's life forever. Though Heinrich Schopenhauer was only 65, his health had rapidly deteriorated. He appeared jaundiced, fatigued, depressed, and confused, often not recognizing old acquaintances. On the 20th of April, 1805, he managed, despite his infirmity, to travel to his Hamburg warehouse, slowly climb to the upper loft of the granary, and hurl himself out of the window into the Hamburg Canal. A few hours later, his body was found floating in the icy water. Every suicide leaves a wake of shock, guilt, and anger in the survivors, and Arthur experienced all these sentiments. Imagine the complexity of feelings Arthur must have experienced. His love for his father resulted in intense grief and loss. His resentment of his father, later he often spoke of his suffering from his father's excessive hardness, evoked remorse, and the wonderful possibility of liberation must have evoked much guilt. Arthur realized that his father would have forever blocked the path to his becoming a philosopher. In this regard, one thinks of two other great free-thinking moral philosophers, Nietzsche and Sartre, who lost their fathers early in life. Could Nietzsche have become the Antichrist if his father, a Lutheran minister, had not died when Nietzsche was a child? And in his autobiography, Sartre expresses his relief that he was not burdened with the search for his father's approbation. Others, Kierkegaard and Kafka, for example, were not so fortunate. All their lives they were oppressed by the weight of their father's judgment. Though Arthur Schopenhauer's work contains an enormous range of ideas, topics, historical and scientific curiosities, notions and sentiments, there are to be found only a couple of personal tender passages, and each pertains to Heinrich Schopenhauer. In one passage, Arthur expresses pride in his father's honest admission that he was in business to make money, and compares his father's forthrightness to the duplicity of many of his fellow philosophers, particularly Hegel and Fichte, who grasp for wealth, power, and fame all the while pretending they are working for humanity. At the age of 60, he planned to dedicate his complete works to the memory of his father. He worked and reworked the wording of his dedication, which ultimately was never published. One version began, "Noble, excellent spirit to whom I owe everything that I am and that I achieve. Anyone finding in my work any kind of joy, consolation, instruction, let him hear your name and know that, if Heinrich Schopenhauer had not been the man he was, Arthur Schopenhauer would have perished 100 times. The strength of Arthur's filial devotion remains puzzling, given Heinrich's lack of any overt affection toward his son. His letters to Arthur are laced with criticism. For example, "Dancing and riding do not make for a livelihood for a merchant whose letters have to be read and must therefore be well written. Now and then I find that the capital letters in your hand are still veritable monstrosities." Or, "Do not acquire a round back which looks ghastly. If in the dining room one catches sight of someone stooping, one takes him for a disguised tailor or cobbler." In his very last letter, Heinrich instructed his son, "With reference to walking and sitting upright, I advise you request everyone you're with to give you a blow whenever you are caught oblivious of this great matter. This is what children of princes have done, not minding the pain for a short time, rather than appear as oafs all their lives." Arthur was his father's son, resembling him not only physically but temperamentally. When he was 17, his mother wrote him, "I know too well how little you had of a happy sense of youth, how large the disposition for melancholic brooding you received as a sad share of your inheritance from your father." Arthur also inherited his father's deep sense of integrity, which played a decisive role in the dilemma that confronted him following his father's death. Should he stay in the apprenticeship even though he hated the world of commerce? Eventually, he decided to do what his father would have done: honor his pledge. He wrote of his decision, "I continued to hold my position with my merchant patron, partly because my excessive grief had broken the energy of my spirit, partly because I would have had a guilty conscience were I to rescind my father's decision so soon after his death." If Arthur felt immobilized and duty-bound after his father's suicide, his mother had no such inclinations. With the speed of a whirlwind, she changed her entire life. In a letter to the 17-year-old Arthur, she wrote, "Your character is so completely different from mine. You are by nature undecided. I myself am too fast, too resolute." After a few months of widowhood, she sold the Schopenhauer mansion, liquidated the venerable family business, and moved away from Hamburg. She boasted to Arthur, "I will always choose the most exciting option. Consider my choice of residence. Instead of moving to my hometown, back to my friends and relatives, like every other woman would have done in my stead, I chose Weimar, which was almost unknown to me." Why Weimar? Johanna was ambitious and yearned to be close to the epicenter of German culture. Supremely confident of her social abilities, she knew she could make good things happen, and indeed, within months she had created an extraordinary new life for herself. She established the liveliest salon of Weimar and developed a close friendship with Goethe and many other leading writers and artists. Soon she began a career. First, as a successful writer of travel journals chronicling the Schopenhauer's family tour and a trip of southern France. Then, with Goethe's urging, she turned to fiction and wrote a series of romantic novels. She was one of the first truly liberated women and was Germany's first woman to earn her living as a writer. For the next decade, Johanna Schopenhauer became a renowned novelist, the Danielle Steele of 19th century Germany. And for decades, Arthur Schopenhauer was known only as Johanna Schopenhauer's son. In the late 1820s, Johanna's complete works were published in a 20-volume edition. Though history, based greatly on Arthur's scathing criticism of his mother, has generally presented Johanna as narcissistic and uncaring, there is no doubt that she, and only she, liberated Arthur from his servitude and started him on his way to philosophy. The instrument of delivery was a fateful letter she wrote to Arthur in April 1807, 2 years after his father's suicide. Dear Arthur, the serious and calm tone of your March 28th letter, flowing from your mind into my mind, woke me up and revealed that you might be on your way to totally missing your vocation. That is why I have to do each and everything to save you, however possible. I know what it means to live a life repugnant to one's soul, and if it is possible, I will spare you, my dear son, this misery. Oh, dear, dear Arthur, why was it that my voice counted so little? What you want now was in fact then my warmest wish. How hard I strove to make it happen, despite everything one said against me. If you do not wish to be taken into the honorable Philistine order, I, my dear Arthur, truly don't want to put any obstacle into your way. It is just you who have to seek your own way and choose it. Then I will advise and help, where and how I can. First try to come to peace with yourself. Remember, you must choose studies that promise you a good salary, not only because it is the only way you can live, for you will never be rich enough to live from your inheritance alone. If you have made your choice, tell me so. But you have to take this decision on your own. If you feel the strength and heart to do this, I will willingly give you my hand. But just don't imagine life as a complete learned man to be too delightful. I now see it around me, dear Arthur. It is a tiring, troublesome life full of work. Only the delight in doing it gives it its charm. One doesn't get rich with it. As a writer, one acquires with difficulty what one needs for survival. To make your life as a writer, you have to be able to produce something excellent. Now, more than ever, there is a need of brilliant heads. Arthur, think about it carefully and choose, but then stay firm. Let your perseverance never fail, and you will safely achieve your goal. Choose what you want. But with tears in my eyes, I implore you, do not cheat on yourself. Treat yourself seriously and honestly. The welfare of your life is at stake, as well as the happiness of my old days, because only you and Adele can hopefully replace my lost youth. I couldn't bear it to know that you are unhappy, especially if I had to blame myself for having let this great misfortune happen to you out of my too large pliability. You see, dear Arthur, that I dearly love you, and that I want to help you in everything. Reward me by your confidence and, by having once made up your mind, following my advice in fulfilling your choice. And don't hurt me by rebelliousness. You know that I am not stubborn. I know how to give way by arguments, and I will never demand anything from you
I won't be able to support by arguments. Adieu, dear Arthur. The post is urgent and my fingers hurt. Bear in mind all I send and write to you, and answer soon. Your mother, J. Schopenhauer.
In his old age, Arthur wrote, When I finished reading this letter, I shed a flood of tears. By return mail, he opted for liberation from his apprenticeship, and Johanna responded,
That you have so quickly come to a decision against your want would disquiet me in anyone else. I should fear rashness. With you, it reassures me. I regard it as the power of your innermost desires that drives you.
Johanna wasted no time. She notified Arthur's merchant patron and his landlord that Arthur was leaving Hamburg. She organized his move and arranged for him to attend a gymnasium in Gotha, 50 kilometers from his mother's home in Weimar. Arthur's chains were broken. 15. It is noteworthy and remarkable to see how man, besides his life in the concrete, always lives a second life in the abstract, where in the sphere of calm deliberation, what previously possessed him completely and moved him intensely appears to him cold, colorless, and distant. He is a mere spectator and observer. Pam in India. As the Bombay Igatpuri train slowed for a stop at a small village, Pam heard the clangs of ceremonial cymbals and peered through the grimy train window. A dark-eyed boy of about 10 or 11, pointing to her window, ran alongside holding aloft a raised rag and yellow plastic water pail. Since she had arrived in India 2 weeks ago, Pam had been shaking her head no. No to sightseeing guides, shoe shines, freshly squeezed tangerine juice, sari cloth, Nike tennis shoes, money exchange. No to beggars, and no to numerous sexual invitations. Sometimes offered frankly, sometimes offered discreetly by winking, raising eyebrows, licking lips and flicking tongues. And finally, she thought, someone has actually offered me something I need. She vigorously nodded yes, yes to the young window washer, responded with a huge toothy grin. Delighted with Pam's patronage and audience, he washed the pane with long, theatrical flourishes. Paying him generously and shooing him away as he lingered to stare at her, Pam settled back and watched a procession of villagers snake their way down a dusty street, following a priest clad in billowing scarlet trousers and yellow shawl. Their destination was the center of the town square, and a large papier-mâché statue of Lord Ganesha, a short, plump, Buddha-like body bearing an elephant's head. Everyone, the priest, the men dressed in gleaming white, and the women robed in saffron and magenta, carried small Ganesha statues. Young girls scattered handfuls of flowers, and pairs of adolescent boys carried poles holding metal burners emitting clouds of incense. Amid the clash of cymbals and the roll of drums, everyone chanted, Ganapati Bappa Moriya, Percha Varshi Laukariya. Pardon me, can you tell me what they're chanting? Pam turned to the copper-skinned man sitting opposite her, sipping tea, the only other passenger sharing the compartment. He was a delicate, winsome man dressed in a loose white cotton shirt and trousers. At the sound of Pam's voice, he swallowed the wrong way and coughed furiously. Her question delighted him, since he had been attempting, in vain since the train commenced in Bombay, to strike up a conversation with the handsome woman sitting across from him. After a vigorous cough, he replied, with a squeak,
My apologies, madam. Physiology is not always at one's command.
What the people here?
and throughout all of India today are saying is, Beloved Ganapati, Lord of Moria, come again early next year.
Ganapati?
Yes, very confusing, I know. Perhaps you know him by his more common name, Ganesha. He has many other names as well, for example, Vigneshvara, Vinayaka, Gajanana.
And this parade?
The beginning of the 10-day festival of Ganesha. Perhaps you may be fortunate enough to be in Bombay next week at the end of the festival and witness the entire population of the city walk into the ocean and immerse their Ganesha statues in incoming waves.
Oh, and that? A moon or sun?
Pam pointed to four children carrying a large yellow papier-mâché globe. Vijay purred to himself. He welcomed the questions and hoped the train stop would be long, and that this conversation would go on and on. Such voluptuous women were common in American movies, but never before had he had the good fortune to speak to one. This woman's grace and pale beauty stirred his imagination. She seemed to have stepped out of the ancient erotic carvings of the Kama Sutra. And where might this encounter lead, he wondered. Could this be the life-changing event for which he had long sought? He was free. His garment factory had, by Indian standards, made him wealthy. His teenage fiancée died of tuberculosis 2 years ago, and until his parents selected a new bride, he was unencumbered. Ah, it is a moon the children hold. They carry it to honor an old legend. First, you must know that the Lord Ganesha was renowned for his appetite. Note his ample belly. He was once invited for a feast and stuffed himself with dessert pastries called laddus. Have you eaten laddus? Pam shook her head, fearing that he might produce one from his valise. A close friend had contracted hepatitis from a tea shop in India, and thus far she had heeded her physician's advice to eat nothing but 4-star hotel food. When away from the hotel, she had limited herself to food she could peel, mainly tangerines, hard-boiled eggs, and peanuts. My mother made wonderful coconut almond laddus, Vijay continued. Essentially, they are fried flour balls with a sweet cardamom syrup. That sounds prosaic, but you must believe me when I say they are far more than the sum of their ingredients. But back to Lord Ganesha, who was so stuffed that he could not stand up properly. He lost his balance, fell, his stomach burst, and all the laddus tumbled out. This all took place at night with only one witness, the moon, who found the event hilarious. Enraged, Ganesha cursed the moon and banished him from the universe. However, the whole world lamented the moon's absence, and an assembly of gods asked Lord Shiva, Ganesha's father, to persuade him to relent. The penitent moon also apologized for his misbehavior. Finally, Ganesha modified his curse and announced that the moon need be invisible only 1 day a month, partially visible for the remainder of the month, and for 1 day only would be permitted to be visible in its full glory. A brief silence, and Vijay added, And now you know why the moon plays a role in Lord Ganesha festivals.
Thank you for that explanation.
My name is Vijay. Vijay Pandey.
And mine is Pam. Pam Swanville. What a delightful story. And what a fantastical, droll god. That elephant head and Buddha body. And yet the villagers seemed to take their myth so seriously. As though they were really...
It's interesting to consider the iconography of Lord Ganesha. Vijay gently interrupted as he pulled from his shirt a large neck pendant, on which was carved the image of Ganesha. Please note that every feature on Ganesha has a serious meaning,
a life instruction. Consider the large elephant head. It tells us to think big. And the large ears? To listen more. The small eyes remind us to focus and to concentrate. And the small mouth to talk less. And I do not forget Ganesha's instruction. Even at this moment as I talk to you, I remember his counsel and I warn myself not to talk too much. You must help me by telling me when I tell you more than you wish to know.
No, not at all. I'm most interested in your comments on iconography.
There are many others. Here, look closer. We Indians are very serious people.
He reached into the leather bag he wore on his shoulder and held out a small magnifying lens. Taking the glass, Pam leaned over to peer at Vijay's pendant. She inhaled his aroma of cinnamon and cardamom and freshly ironed cotton cloth. How was it possible for him to smell so sweet and so fresh in the close, dusty train compartment?
"He has only one tusk," she observed.
"Meaning, retain the good, throw away the bad."
"And what's that he holds? An axe?"
"To cut off all bonds of attachment."
"That sounds like Buddhist doctrine."
"Yes. Remember that the Buddha emerged from the mother ocean of Shiva."
"And Ganesha holds something in the other hand. It's hard to see. A thread?"
"A rope to pull one ever closer to your highest goal."
The train suddenly lurched and began to move forward.
"Our vehicle is alive again," said Vijay. "Note Ganesha's vehicle. Bare under his foot."
Pam moved closer to look through the lens and inhale Vijay's scent discreetly.
"Oh yes, the mouse. I've seen it in every statue and painting of Ganesha. I've never known why a mouse."
"That's the most interesting attribute of all. The mouse is desire. You may ride it, but only if you keep it under control. Otherwise, it causes havoc."
Pam fell silent. As the train chugged on past scrawny trees, occasional temples, water buffalo in muddy ponds, and farms whose red soil has been exhausted by thousands of years of work, she looked at Vijay and felt a wave of gratitude. How unobtrusively, how gently, he had taken out his pendant and saved her from the embarrassment of speaking irreverently about his religion. When had she ever been so graced by a man? But no, she reminded herself, don't shortchange other dear men. She thought about her group. There was Tony, who would do anything for her. And Stuart, too, who could be generous. And Julius, whose love seemed unending. But Vijay's subtlety, that was uncommon, that was exotic. And Vijay? He too fell into a reverie, reviewing his conversation with Pam. Uncommonly excited, his heart raced, and he sought to calm himself. Opening his leather shoulder pouch, he took out an old, wrinkled cigarette package. Not to smoke. The package was empty, and besides, he had heard of how peculiar Americans were about smoking. He merely wished to study the blue and white package, which bore the silhouette of a man wearing a top hat and, in firm black letters, the brand name, The Passing Show. One of his first religious teachers had called his attention to The Passing Show, a brand of cigarettes his father smoked, and instructed him to begin his meditation by thinking of all of life as a passing show. A river carrying all objects, all experience, all desires, past his unswerving attention. Vijay meditated on the image of a flowing river and listened to his mind's soundless words. Anitya, anitya, impermanence. Everything is impermanent, he reminded himself. All of life and all experience glide by as surely and irrevocably as the passing landscape seen through the train window. He closed his eyes, breathed deeply, and rested his head upon his seat. His pulse slowed as he entered the welcome harbor of equanimity. Pam, who had been eyeing Vijay discreetly, picked up the wrapping that had fallen to the floor, read the label and said,
"The Passing Show. That's an unusual name for cigarettes."
Vijay slowly opened his eyes and said, "As I said, we Indians are very serious. Even our cigarette packages have messages for the conduct of life. Life is a passing show. I meditate on that whenever I feel inner turbulence."
"Is that what you were just doing a minute ago? I should not have disturbed you."
Vijay smiled and gently shook his head. "My teacher once said that one cannot be disturbed by another. It is only oneself who can disturb one's equanimity."
Vijay hesitated, realizing even as it happened that he was awash in desire.
He so craved the attention of his traveling companion that he had turned his meditation practice into a mere curiosity, all for the sake of a smile from this lovely woman who was simply an apparition, part of the passing show, soon to pass out of his life and to dissolve into the non-being of the past. And knowing, too, that his next words would only take him farther from his path, Vijay nonetheless rashly plunged ahead. "There is something I would like to say. I shall long treasure our meeting and our conversation. Shortly I shall depart from this train to an ashram where I must face silence for the next 10 days. And I am immeasurably grateful for the words we have exchanged, the moments we have shared. I am reminded of American prison films, where the condemned man is permitted to order anything he wishes for his last meal. May I say that I have had my wishes for our last conversation fully granted." Pam simply nodded. Rarely at a loss for words, she did not know how to respond directly to Vijay's courtliness.
10 days at an ashram? Do you mean Igatpuri? I'm on my way there to retreat."
"Then we have the same destination and the same goal. To be taught Vipassana meditation by the honored guru Goenka. And very soon, too, it is the next stop."
"Did you say 10 days of silence?"
"Yes. Goenka always requires noble silence. Aside from necessary discussions with the staff, the students are to utter no words." "Are you experienced in meditation?" Pam shook her head no.
"I'm a university professor. I teach English literature, and last year one of my students had a healing and transformative experience at Igatpuri. This student has become very active in organizing Vipassana retreats in the United States, and she is currently helping to plan an American tour by Goenka."
"Your student hoped to offer her teacher a gift. She wished that you, too, would undergo a transformation?"
"Well, something like that. It wasn't that she felt I needed to change some particular thing about myself. It was more that she had profited so much that she wanted me, and others, to have the same experience."
"Of course. My question was ill put. In no way did I mean to suggest that you need transformation. I was interested in your student's enthusiasm. But did she prepare you for this retreat in any way?"
"She pointedly did not. She herself stumbled upon this retreat quite by accident, and said that it would be best if I too entered it with an entirely open mind. You're shaking your head, you disagree?"
"Ah,
Remember that Indians shake their heads from side to side when they agree, and up and down when they disagree. The reverse of the American custom.
Oh my God. I think I've sensed this unconsciously because so much of my interaction with people here has been slightly askew. I must have confused people I spoke with.
No.